I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. Today we're talking about, should you just NPM install random code? Can you trust all of the random code that is 47 dependencies deep on NPM? We've got Faraz on from socket.dev, as well as like, we'll wait till a little later on to talk about it, but I do want to talk about WebTorrent and Wormhole as well, because I think that is super cool. But welcome, Frost. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks for having me. It's super cool to be here. Excited to talk with you guys.
Yeah. So we recommended to you from Darcy. I've met you before on other things that you were working on. But it seems like you've been working on socket.dev for, about a year now or so? Or is it longer than that?
Actually, going on more like 2 years. Yeah, it's been a little while. Yeah, well, I guess we launched it about a year and a half ago, so that's probably what you're thinking. But we were working on it for a little bit before that too. Yeah.
Okay. And what is socket.dev?
Yeah, we usually just call it socket, but yeah, the URL is socket.dev. That's where you can go and learn about it. So it's a developer tool for it helps you pick open source packages, and so you can kind of use it to understand your open source dependencies, what the risks are of using the packages. And then it's kind of a whole like security platform as well. So you can start off as a developer just using it to kind of do your research, and you can use it instead of npmjs.com or using Google. And instead you can start at Socket and just type in, you know, what you're looking for. And it's sort of like a package browser type tool. And it'll tell you lots of useful things about the packages. For example, they could be malware. It'll tell you don't install them. it also might tell you that, you know, they're not maintained anymore, or they appear to be, you know, contain some suspicious code. Maybe they're stealing some of your environment variables and your API keys and sending them off to a random URL, a random IP address. So we do like pretty thorough scans of these packages, and we're trying to make it like really easy for developers to understand like what's going on without having them need to go in and open up every file of that dependency and all of its, you know, additional dependencies all the way down to truly get an understanding of the risk of the package. And then security teams can also use it to kind of get a bigger picture of like what is going on, but we're mostly developers here, so I'll just focus on the developer side of things.
Yeah. Honestly, I really like it, and it's starting to show up in my search results when I look for a package, which I quite like, because at the very least, the security stuff aside, it's a better NPM website than npm.com or whatever NPM's website is. It shows you like more information about what you want. Like sometimes you do a search on NPM for like a package for like, I don't know, just search for async. You know, and they give you these P, Q, and M bar charts. And like, I don't know what that is. I don't know what that means, you know? And it's nice to get a little bit more insights into, is this a good quality package or not? And how many people are maintaining it? And NPM does show you quite a bit of that stuff, but there's a lot more I wish I could get out of the NPM website.
Yeah. And we're trying to make our pages better all the time too. So, one thing we just rolled out that's really exciting that literally came out today as we're recording this on November 21st is, AI package summaries. So we're literally, using ChatGPT. We're pumping in kind of the README and like whatever docs information we can grab. And we're having it, write like a better README for the package than the package came with. Cause sometimes you have these packages, which, you know, it's not very consistent. Some people have great READMEs. Other people just link off to some random URL and tell you to go there. And some of them don't really have like very fleshed out READMEs. And so we actually can give you like a really cool description of what the package does, along with like all the main features of the package with code samples showing you how to use the package. And finally, even similar like related packages, along with like like written out explanations for like what the differences are. So if you're looking at Lodash, we'll tell you, you know, well, you know, you might want to consider underscore, and it's like, oh, that's actually a bad example because underscore is deprecated, but other way around, you know, it might tell you why you should consider the other one because it's not deprecated and that type of thing. So it's pretty cool. And we're always trying to be like ahead of where like the NPM website is. So like when we first started, NPM's website didn't even have like a file explorer to let you see the files inside the packages, which it turns out if you're actually trying to vet a package and see if it's safe to use or not, like you really want to look at the source of truth, which is like, what are the files in the NPM package? And because they weren't showing it on their website, most people, myself included, would have to basically click the GitHub link, go to GitHub, and just like look in the GitHub repo and assume like, okay, this is probably the same thing that's in the NPM package. But it turns out like that's not actually true. You can put completely different code on GitHub than what you put into the published package. And they're completely separate. There's no connection between them other than, you know, this little link that goes from the NPM website back, which is like, I promise that the code in this repo is the same as the code in this package, but that's totally not enforced. So it turns out that's a great way to hide malware or like sketchy things in your packages. So, so you know, we had that from day one. We're like, we're going to show people the files, the actual source of truth. Although I think NPM has now since also added that feature, mostly because I was going around talking about this for like a year, and I think they finally got humiliated into like actually adding it. But
that makes so much sense too. Yeah, yeah, because you do. You just click the link in, and I've never thought twice about it, even though I've published packages and I know how that connection is. So it's like, why had nobody thought about that before? Other than you're just like, oh yeah, of course we're gonna go right to the GitHub link and see the files. Sure. Mm-hmm. One thing I really love is these scores. It makes it nice and easy for people like me to see this kind of stuff. You know, I think there's tools like, you know, like Lighthouse gives us for performance, whatever. Everybody likes a big green number score or whatever, big colored green, red, whatever. And being able to see very quickly like how much of a package has had maintenance on it, how many open issues there are, their severity, how much the supply chain security, it has had 570,000 downloads this week, low level security issues. Man, it feels like this gives so much easy access to visibility. Was that the biggest driver here, is to give people visibility?
Yeah, exactly. So I was a maintainer for, you know, most of my 20s. I started writing open source when I was in college. And then, you know, I really got into it for real after my first company that I started got bought by Yahoo. We were like a super small team. So they were really just hiring the three of us to go and work at Yahoo. And I was kind of disappointed that they ended up really not using the technology that we built at that company. And so I left after a year, and my mission was, I'm going to build an open source version of that, you know, product that they had acquired, which was a peer-to-peer CDN. So it was kind of like, you know, a way to offload some of the traffic of your hosting the files on your website to your visitors and have them do like a peer-to-peer kind of file transfer between each other, and sort of make your site faster and more resilient and not completely reliant on centralized servers. And so anyway, I ended up turning into WebTorrent, which Wes already mentioned earlier. But I got really into this like idea of like, we need to make, you know, the web peer to peer, and we need to like make it so that you don't need to install a desktop app to use torrents, and make it so it's just as easy as like going to YouTube. You can just go to a website and you click play, and then it turns out behind the scenes it's actually getting the content from a bunch of other people all across the world. And so I got really into open source, and and then that's kind of where I started realizing how crazy open source actually is. If you think about it, like, everybody's downloading all this code from people on the internet, including people like me. And I was like a random 20 something year old, and the Fortune 500 was using my code to ship their expensive products that were like, you know, that are all super serious and important. And I was like, well, that's incredible, right? They don't even know who I am. And I just, you know, I just started like publishing this stuff like not that long ago. I wasn't very good when I started. And so that was really cool, but it was also kind of like eye-opening, like, wow, so this is how software is made. Developers are just grabbing stuff And it might depend on something written by like a random person who just started coding like a couple years before. Like, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know,
it is wild. And there's no possible way that anybody could go comb through every single line of your node modules, because there's literally millions of packages in there, and often they're compiled, they're minified. So even if you could read through every single line, you're not going to be able to parse what's going on when all the variables are concatenated on the same line, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the security stuff, I'm curious about what can happen and how do you detect possible security issues that are out there, right? Like, I remember back in the WordPress days, they would scan and simply look for like base64 encoded strings that would inject JavaScript into the page. That was like the big thing, you know? And sometimes if you had intentionally base64 encoded code in there because it was like a license key or something like that, then it got flagged. So like, how do you figure out what's going wrong and what could bad actors actually do?
Well, okay, I'll give you one story. And this is the thing that really got me excited or like interested in this problem. And it was something that happened in 2018. There was this open source maintainer, a friend of mine named Dominic Tarr. And he was, do you guys remember Dominic Tarr?
Yep.
Did you use any of his code at any point? So he was a prolific maintainer. I think he had at the time, you know, when I was working with him on stuff, he had like 500 NPM packages that he'd written. So he is just like an incredibly creative and like generative person. He was just always writing stuff and publishing it out there. And he was very experimental. So he made this one package called Event Stream, which was his take on like how to do streams in JavaScript and in Node. And he quickly kind of moved on from that and came up with a different way to do streams called push streams. And then he then moved on to a better thing called pull streams. And he kept, you know, kind of iterating and coming up with these new streaming paradigms. And some of this stuff was, you know, influential in the Node.js stream implementation and stuff like that. But it turns out that the first package he made, Event Stream, got really popular, even though he had kind of mentally moved on to like the next, you know, two projects that he was working on in that area. And despite the fact that like he wasn't really working on it anymore, thinking about it, it just kept getting more and more downloads and getting more and more, you know, people depending on it. And at some point somebody came to him and said, "Hey, you haven't really worked on this package in 4 years, but it's used by my company and there's some critical bugs in it. And I'd love to, you know, offer my time to help fix those." And he did what most maintainers do when they're kind of through with working on a project, which is he just said, like, "Okay, sure. Like, here's the NPM." You know, he gave them NPM publish permission and gave them the GitHub repo permissions.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, like, actually did pretty reasonable things for the first 30 days. He kind of bumped some dependencies, you know, he fixed a few of the bugs. But then it turns out like after those 30 days, then he did what he really was intending to do, which was he added a big blob of code that was totally obfuscated. So you couldn't tell at first glance what it was doing, although it did look pretty sketchy. And he just added it to the bottom of one of the files of one of the dependencies. And nobody noticed this for like about 6 days. And remember, this is a package that like everybody uses. Like it was on everyone's computers. And this thing, it was so sneaky because it didn't actually do anything unless it was running in a very particular environment. It was designed to target one particular company. So it probably ran on my computer, probably ran on your computers, but it didn't do anything. Because it was literally like the first thing it does is it would look at the parent project that it's running in. So it would go up to the top package JSON file and it would take the description field and it would use that as a decryption key to decrypt this payload of malicious code. And so if it was running in like your project or my project, it would fail to decrypt and it would therefore do nothing. But for this one like company they were targeting, it would actually run. And so then it ended up getting built into that company's Electron app and it got shipped to their users and nobody found it until after it was already like running, you know, on the user's machines. And what it did was it actually stole all their cryptocurrency. As you can imagine, there's always crypto involved in some way here. But yeah.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah. Wow. So how does somebody find something like that?
Well, so the community found this one because, you know, it turns out it we got incredibly lucky. The attacker happened to, in their code, they happened to use a method that got deprecated by Node.js in like a couple of days later in the new Node version that came out. And so a bunch of people who were using that new version of Node got this deprecation warning and were curious about it and traced it back to this one file. And then, you know, somebody opened an issue and said, what the heck is this code doing in here? This looks really sketchy. And then the community kind of like investigated it and we're able to kind of get to the bottom of it. But like, I kept seeing that type of thing happen where like a totally like obvious piece of bad code was added. If anyone had just taken like 2 seconds to look at the file, they would have seen that and been like, what the heck is this? Right. And then a total accident causes us to discover it. And that happened like multiple times over like 2018, 2019, 2020 with people like doing this type of thing in various ways to open source packages. And each time it happened, I was always like super scared, like, wow, did I happen to run that code? And I would search my node modules folder. I'd wrote a little shell script to see if I had it in any of my folders and any of my projects. And every time I got super lucky and I never was affected. But I remember thinking like, there has to be a better way than like hoping that the community finds it before I install it. And that's kind of where the idea came from.
Man. And so how does Socket, obviously it scans your code, but like what are you looking for? Are you looking for methods? Are you looking for, do you have a massive regex for sketchy stuff?
Yeah. So yeah, there's a bit of like custom knowledge that's just from like us, you know, being maintainers, because our whole team is mostly made up of like open source maintainers who've been doing this for quite a while and who've seen a lot of these attacks. Mm-hmm. So some of it is definitely like lists of hard coded things, but there's also quite a lot of like a variety of signals that we're looking for. So I'll give you like one example, right? So if you've been using a dependency in your company for, you know, or in your one of your projects, you know, for the last couple of years, and that package has never needed to make any network requests or like read any of your environment variables, and suddenly now like a new patch version is published and that patch version is reading environment variables and sending those to the network, then, you know, that's like a suspicious change. Even if, you know, maybe it's legitimate, it's possible it's legitimate, but, you know, that's an example of something that's like, it's a pretty significant change to the risk profile of the package. Other examples might be like it added an install script. So now the package is running code automatically on installation. That turns out to be something that almost all malware authors love to do because they want their attack to run right away. So they'll just put it into an install script. So if you see these things, it doesn't necessarily mean you're dealing with like a hijacked or compromised package, but it's definitely like worth a second look. And so what we do at Socket is we have like about 70 of these signals. And if there's enough of them that we find in a package, we will actually put it into ChatGPT. I kid you not. we actually have an LLM in the process, which actually helps us to explain the code and understand what is it doing?
Yeah.
Like why is it collecting this data? What is it doing with the data? And then we have it actually determine whether it's suspiciousness is, you know, worthy of a human review. And so that then puts it into a human review queue. And then we have literally a team of like security experts that look at anything that ends up in that queue and mark it as like malware or not malware. So it's like a multi-step process. Yeah.
Wow. And and this is just constantly happening every time someone publishes something to NPM. Like, are you ingesting all of NPM? This is something we asked Darcy, is how big is NPM, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we have a complete copy of NPM, a complete copy of PyPy, and a complete copy to the extent, well, I'll put an asterisk on that one, for Go. Because Go doesn't really have like a central, you know, as much of a centralized registry as the other ecosystems. Yeah. And what we do is we actually scan every package that's been published that has at least 500 downloads ever. And then what we do is for all new publishes, we follow the NPM feed in real time. And we download those packages right away and scan them, even if they don't have that many downloads. And that's really interesting and useful to do, because a lot of times the newly published stuff can give you a hint as to like an attack that's happening. Like you might spot it in a newly published package. And so it's really useful for us to collect those packages. And the other thing that's really useful about collecting them is that if somebody reports them as malware and they get deleted, which happens sometimes, then we already have a copy of that package that we've collected that we can use to improve our training. So if we ever miss something, we'll be able to improve our systems.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I'm looking at a couple of the unpublished packages that were nabbed as malware, and it's kind of interesting to see, like, one of them just put a curl in a pre-install script. You know, it was just a test, but it's an example of, yeah, before you install it, you could just literally run curl. Like you could RMRF someone's entire hard drive, couldn't you?
Yeah, someone literally did that. So there was literally during the like the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. And I don't want to get political here because it doesn't really have anything to do with your position on the war. But but somebody was protesting, and so there's this thing that started during that time called protestware, which was a bunch of maintainers just mm-hmm. decided to start using their influence with their packages to kind of promote their political positions, which I totally get. You know, I mean, I've definitely done a bit of some of that myself when it comes to like getting open source maintainers some funding, you know, and I've done some funding experiments that we could talk about if you're interested. But but basically, this person decided that they wanted to like take it to the extreme. So they added a bit of code that would check your IP address. And if it appeared to be a Russian IP, then it would just RMRF your hard drive. And it did it in like this really hilarious way where it would like go one file at a time, and it wouldn't just delete it. It would actually replace the contents with a flower emoji. So your whole hard drive would just get filled with flower emoji files.
Oh gosh.
It was really intense. And they've got a lot of pushback from the community about that, because, you know, there are people who could be using a VPN who could be affected by that, who aren't even the intended target. And then it could also be like just innocent people being affected. So anyway, this person ended up, I think, taking that code out, or it got taken down in some way. But that's like an example. There's been less extreme examples of similar people protesting where they'll do things like, we've seen one where they added a set timeout into their front end code that would wait 15 seconds. And then it would open a pop-up window to a petition website. And it would only do it if your computer's time zone was set to Eastern European time zones. So if you're only testing it like in America or Europe or whatever, you wouldn't even know that this like extra code was in there that was running on some people's browsers. So that was one that actually was, I thought, was particularly interesting, because GitHub and NPM decided not to take that code down after they learned about it. Because they considered, I don't know their exact reasons, but it seems to me that they considered that to be like not crossing the line into malicious behavior enough that they wanted to actually go and delete it. And so they kind of, I guess, thought of it more as like a freedom of speech thing. And so they kept the code up there. And so till this day, it's been up for like over a year now. Till this day, if you install that package, which is a very popular polyfill package, you're actually embedding this code into your website that's going to be doing like this extra pop-up window thing on some people's browsers.
Really?
Yeah.
What? Still, can you name which one that is? I'm just curious. Or do you not want to get into it?
No, I'm happy to name it. I mean, like, look, I'm not trying to judge anyone here. Everyone has, you know, like I said, everyone has their reasons for doing what they do. But the whole point of Socket and our whole goal is, like, we just want to provide information to people about what these packages are doing. We're not trying to like necessarily judge anybody. We're just saying, like, look, if you're building an app, like, you should know what your dependencies are doing. Like,
totally.
So it's fine if it's still on NPM, but we just, on Socket, we put a big warning on the top of that that says this thing is not, you know, this thing has protestware in it, and it has potentially unwanted additional behavior. Yeah. So it's called event source polyfill. That's the package. Event-source-polyfill. And if you visit that page on socket.dev, you'll see that, and if you go back to the version that's affected, which is 1.0.26, then you'll see the hidden code in there, and it's quite interesting. I'll drop a link into the show notes for people if they want to take a look at the diff there.
It feels like that type of I guess you would call that an attack, even though it's not like super malicious. I guess that type of attack, it seems to be that the message is that if you're making those types of attacks, you don't have them affect everyone, and they can last longer before they're discovered, or they're maybe a little bit more compartmentalized into who they're affecting. Because I guess that's where your service comes in handy, because, right, you now you're not relying on user reports. You're actually scoping these things out before it gets there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a whole world. Yeah.
That's the whole intention, right? Is like, we shouldn't be reactive. We shouldn't be sitting around waiting for like somebody mm-hmm. to discover these things. Like, we're programmers. Like, we're smart. We have computers. We have automation. We have, you know, like we have servers. Like, we can just scan for this stuff, and, you know, and you can enumerate all the things, and you can even use LLMs as like a stopgap where, you know, even if you can't definitively say that something's malicious, you can even like get a second opinion from an LLM, which turns out is actually surprisingly effective, and you can catch a lot of this stuff. So, you know, we find like, I think it's about 400 malicious packages per week now, that we
Whoa.
Discover.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Wow. I
probably could sit here all day and listen to stories, but like, like what other kinds of stuff are people trying to do? You know, like, I get like probably crypto is a big one. Obviously protests is a big one. Is there any other like major categories of nefarious people?
One thing we've noticed that definitely gets our attention is when people start spam campaigns on NPM. This is when somebody publishes a package to NPM that just contains a README that has a bunch of links to their spam sites that they're trying to promote for SEO purposes. Mm-hmm. And they do this because they realize that there's actually hundreds of websites out there that will just replicate any NPM package. Socket is one of those. You know, we have a page for every NPM package. So it turns out the spammers realized, okay, well, if we want to just get like 300 free links from people on the internet, we can just publish, you know, a README with our links, and then all these, you know, hundreds of sites will just start linking to us for free. And so there was this massive spam attack that happened earlier this year that was trying to promote the new John Wick movie. And it was crazy. There was like actually about 5,000 NPM packages published about John Wick in a single day.
Oh my gosh. What?
Like, somebody obviously got paid to SEO, and it probably got passed down like 3 or 4 contractors, and then someone did that.
Exactly. And it was pretty blatant, and it was to the point where like, if you look at a chart of the number of packages on NPM, this John Wick spam attack shows up as like a massive spike, and you can just, it stands out as very clearly there. And at one point it was something like 0.05% or something like that of the NPM registry was just dedicated to John Wick spam. And for that couple of days when they were doing this, it was 50% of the NPM publishes were about John Wick.
Oh my gosh. I do not envy the people that have to sort of deal with that type of stuff as it pops up. People just being, I've had to deal with a handful of people trying to be nefarious, and it's always such a pain in the butt because it happens when you're least expecting it and you got to scramble to fix stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what happens when you run basically what's a big public wiki. I mean, that's kind of what NPM, I mean, it's the beauty of it. And it's also it's the bad part of it. Like, anyone can publish, which is amazing. It means that, like, you know, when I was learning how to do open source, I was able to just put my terrible code online and, you know, and it felt like, you know, pretty cool to be able to publish with, you know, one command. And that was what Isaac, I think that's why NPM was so successful, is that decision he made to build that NPM publish command right into NPM and to make it like one command. Like, there's no vetting process. There's no, like, you know, even just the fact that Python, I think, takes like 2 or 3 commands to publish, like, makes it so much less like fun to do. And you have to remember the order, and it's annoying flags and everything. And NPM just made it really, really easy. So it's why NPM grew so much and is what it is today, and all this great creativity and, you know, and people like me who started off publishing terrible code eventually started publishing better code and, you know, learned, and it's awesome. But it also means that anyone can publish anything they want. And if you are unfortunate enough to make a typo when you're typing npm install and you install like one letter off package, you're just going to be getting someone's random garbage. it's terrible.
Yeah, that was my next question, is how do you, so how does Socket, like how do I hook it up to my project as well as my GitHub? Like if I'm a boss at a bank and I've got 500 devs that are npm installing all day, how do I make sure that 3 minutes ago somebody published a nefarious package version and then somebody, it's like a point release. So someone types npm install, boom, post install, hack the entire bank. Like how does Socket stop you? Does it run at the npm install level or how does it work?
Yeah, great question. Most people install our GitHub integration because it's pretty easy to do. It takes like two clicks and we're in the GitHub marketplace and you can just find Socket there and click install, click all repos, and then we'll start giving you feedback on pull requests. If anytime you add a dependency or update a dependency, you'll get feedback in the PR that tells you, you know, hey, this is like a risk that we found. You might not want to merge this. And then your whole team can see it. And so it's a very easy way to get going. But you're totally right that you also want to protect the developer's machine too. So if they're if they're running npm install, you don't want to wait until the PR to catch the problem. You actually want to stop it before the, you know, before that bad package even runs on their computer. So we built this thing we call Safe NPM, which is really like an npm wrapper. It wraps the CLI so that when you run npm install, you actually, you alias the npm command so that it's actually running Socket npm. And that will actually figure out what packages are about to be installed on your machine and then whether any of those have serious risks. And if there is a risk, like say you typo it, like say you type npm install React with an S on the end instead of React, then we will like print a message that says, hey, this appears to be a typo squat. Like, are you sure you wanted to install React? And then if you say, you get like a yes, no prompt. And if you say no, then it will abort the installation before the package code has even been downloaded onto your computer. So you're totally safe. It like never touches your machines.
And do you recommend like pinning your dependencies in your package JSON? Or like, I guess you would have to go even further into the, like the lock file. Is that what the Saran wrap is? What's all those packages?
They call it shrink wrap. I know what you're talking
shrink
about.
Shrink wrap, yeah. Not Saran wrap.
Might be a lawsuit.
Oh, that's good. Saran wrap. Shrink wrap, yes. Is that what shrink wrap is, where you pin all your dependencies all the way down your tree?
So I would say today there's no need to ever use shrink wrap. It's kind of a deprecated thing. I think maybe there's a use case or two left for it, but for the most part, people should just use lock files. Lock file does just pretty much what you want, which is it goes down the whole tree and it pins everything down to an exact version. And if you do that, then you're going to get like a reproducible install when someone else on your team clones the GitHub repo and onto their machine and they run npm install. They're going to get the same set of dependencies. For the most part, I will say there's a little asterisk on that, which is that if you're using an HTTP dependency or a Git URL in your dependencies, you know, some, I don't know if you know that, but you can actually put like a, literally you can put like a random HTTP URL in as instead of a version, and then it will just download the code that's there, and then you completely bypass your whole lock file. But assuming you don't do that, then you get like a pretty nice reproducible kind of build where the versions are never changing out from underneath you without you knowing. But I would say that you still have this problem, which is that like, okay, so now I have this lock file, but nobody looks at the lock file. GitHub doesn't even show you the diff when the lock file changes because it's so giant that they just compress it down and say the file's been hidden. So like in practice, it's cool that the lock file's there. It's cool that you have like a log of like what versions you were depending on. But in practice, most people will, you know, install stuff and then it'll change the lock file and they never look at it and they're never really using it to
merge conflict. If I'll tell you what I do when there's a merge conflict, delete the whole thing and install again, you know, can't be dealing with that.
I've done that before.
Absolutely.
But talking about that Git issue, that's a possible issue. So the other day I was on some GitHub issue and someone said someone had fixed a bug, but they didn't publish a new version. And like that happens all the time. We're like, can you please, please, please just publish a new version? And then somebody comes along and says, hey, put this in your package JSON. And they basically just like directed it to a Git repo. And then there's like 1,000 thumbs ups on it. And I went right below it. I was like, hey, folks, like at least pin this to the commit. So I updated it and said, like, I put the commit hash on the end so that, like, first of all, they might have a breaking change and you're going to be out of luck. But second of all, you could put malicious code in there. And if it's not pinned to that commit, you are in trouble, friend.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Yeah, I mean, look, developers just want to get their job done. I mean, they're not like, not everyone's a security expert. And a lot of times you just want to like get something working. So I totally understand the reason why that got so many thumbs ups. It's because it solves a problem that people have.
Yeah, I remember back in the WordPress days when WordPress would have, or like Apache or something would have, or your server would have issues with a plugin, like saving files. And there was always some guy coming in being like, just shmod it 777 and it works. And everyone's like, thank you, thank you. And like no one's realizing that you just like opened up a like wide open read, write, whatever. What's read, write? What's the third one?
Execute.
Yeah, exactly. The really important one. Wide open to absolutely everyone. So it's sometimes those quick fixes are hurt.
Probably back in the day too, when you were doing this stuff, it was on like a shared web host back where, you know, like shared hosting where like, you know, you'd have everybody on one machine. And so that 777 probably really did open it up to like everybody else at the web host.
let's talk about WebTorrent, and you have another project called Wormhole. And like my mind was blown when WebTorrent came out because, like, first of all, it was a torrent app built in JavaScript, but then it also played it. And then I saw you, you go to webtorrent.io, and it starts downloading, like, a video file, and it's peering it to other people that are on the website as well. And at the time, I was like, man, like, I have, my entire business is streaming video. Bandwidth at the time was super expensive, and I was like, what if the people watching my videos could be serving it up to the other people watching it? You know, like that's the whole idea behind torrents is you have this peer network. How do you implement the torrent spec, I guess, in JavaScript?
I mean, JavaScript is a programming language like any other. Yeah. So yeah. It's a real programming language. You can do things in it. I think at the time, it was sort of shocking. Like when I started WebTorrent, it was 2013, I think, is when I started working on it. And, you know, Node was pretty new. People were still skeptical that you should even be using JavaScript on the back end of a server. People hadn't really started using it for hardware yet. Those early Node conferences, there were people putting Node on quadcopters, and there was like, you know, the Node Copter project, and there's all this stuff, Johnny
Node
Five.
Boats, yeah.
Yeah, Node Boats, yeah. So like it was people were trying to show like, hey, JavaScript can do anything any other language can. And so it was surprising to a lot of people that you could build a torrent app in JavaScript. But really, it turns out it's actually a really good, Node is a really good platform for building a torrent app, because so much of torrenting is actually having a ton of open connections to a bunch of different people on the internet, and Node being like a non-blocking, you know, event loop based, you know, kind of server kind of, programming paradigm means that you can open up connections to like 100 peers, keep those sockets open, and then just kind of react to the events when data comes across them. And it's actually a pretty amazing way to it's a pretty amazing environment to actually code a torrent app in. You don't need threads or, you know, things like that to make it, work. And so, yeah, I just started by building like a normal BitTorrent app in JavaScript. So I read the spec, and it turns out BitTorrent is actually pretty simple. It's a really great way for people who are interested in like peer-to-peer stuff or networking stuff to get and even security stuff, I would say, because obviously when you're dealing with untrusted random people on the internet, like sending you stuff, the aspect of the torrent where you actually like hash the contents and verify that it's what you're expecting is actually pretty important to do.
Yeah.
It's a really simple, relatively simple protocol. You can read the spec probably in like 20 minutes. Like it's just a it's like a one pager kind of thing, like you, or maybe two or three pages, and you can build a torrent app that like works. You know, I started off with that, and then I, you know, I knew that the cool thing was by building it in JavaScript, like in theory, you could run it in a web browser too. But the problem with the web browser environment is you can't actually open up a socket. Like you can't do TCP or UDP sockets. You only have like a WebSocket or WebRTC. Those are your two other choices. Mm-hmm. And so like a WebSocket isn't useful because it means you're only going to be able to connect to a web server. And we're trying to build like a peer-to-peer network where my browser tab can connect to your browser tab. And so a WebSocket doesn't really work for that. And that's actually part of the problem with the web, to be honest with you, is like it's as cool as it is, like it was really designed to be like a client-server relationship. So the server has a lot of power, and the client, the browser, is pretty, can't really function without like a server. So there's always you start with by typing in a URL, and the URL, you know, does a DNS lookup, and then it connects to a server. There's no way to have a peer-to-peer website, really, unfortunately. So you always got to start with a connection to a server. But the idea with WebTorrent was, well, once you connect to the server and you get your initial JavaScript app, could you then just be fully peer-to-peer from that point on and just connect to peers to get all your content? And it turns out you can do that with WebRTC, which is what WebTorrent uses. And so that's kind of how it works. It's the same technology that's used to make video chat applications like Google Meet or
Riverside.
Other examples.
What we're chatting on right now. Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
So yeah, that's how it uses it. So it uses WebRTC and really there's this one part of WebRTC that nobody really focused much on before I think WebTorrent really kind of drew a lot of attention to it. Maybe that's too strong of a statement to say, but I just think a lot of people were really focused on kind of video and voice uses of WebRTC because that's what it was made for. But there was this third part that was really like cool that I didn't think there was enough attention on, which is they called it the data channel. And that was basically like a way to just get like a similar interface to a WebSocket where you just like can send data and you can receive data over a socket connection. And you could do that with any other browser on the internet. And once you have that, you can basically make any protocol you want. It doesn't have to be like a voice call or a video call. You can just send whatever files you want over it. And that's pretty powerful because you can build anything with that.
That's so cool. And you didn't run into issues. Like anytime I get into WebRTC, it's always like, yeah, you can connect peer-to-peer, but most people have firewalls in place and you have to use this like $6,000 a month service to do your turn stun server handshake thing. Did you have to do that as well?
Yeah. So there are some details there to get it working correctly. But I will say, here's the cool thing about torrents, right? Like you don't need to connect successfully to every peer. You just need to connect to some, right? So unlike a video call where like if I'm trying to call my mom and like the connection can't connect to her, then I'm going to be really upset. With a torrent, I'm trying to connect to maybe 100 peers, but if I can only connect to 60 of them, like it's fine, it still works. So that's the advantage of the torrent use case.
And you also built Wormhole, which is basically a spot where you can drop a file and it will encrypt it, and then you can send somebody the link and they can download that. And I read through it. I know under 5 gigs, it will throw it on a Backblaze bucket. And then over 5 gigs, you can literally peer-to-peer send large files that someone has to keep their tab open. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wormhole is I built with a friend, John, who's also now at Socket. And this was like a project that we both started together that ended up actually leading to the idea for Socket. And that's because our goal with Wormhole was to build something that was as secure as humanly possible on the web. So unlike other services like Dropbox that can see all your files, you know, Google Drive has the same problem. You're giving a copy of your files to them and they can see the files. With Wormhole, it's end-to-end encrypted, similar to like Signal messaging app where, you know, only you and the recipient can see the contents. We did everything we could to make this thing as secure as humanly possible. So like, you know, it uses the same crypto that was used in and I mean, when I say crypto, I mean cryptography.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
The same cryptography that was used in Firefox Send. You guys remember that? Do you remember that app?
Yep.
So they shut down for some reason. And so, you know, we wanted to basically build like that, but even more secure and with even better user experience. So we started with their cryptography. And so we knew that it was vetted to some extent. And then we improved that further. And then we made the UX of Wormhole as good as we could possibly think to make it. And so like, I'll give you an example. Like one thing we did that was just bonkers, like an insane amount of engineering work to do, but we wanted to do it because we thought it would make it better, which is with a lot of these services, you drop like your files on the page, or even take like Google Drive, right? You want to say, you want to share a link to somebody using Google Drive. So you drop your files into Google Drive and then it starts to upload, right? And it might say like 4 hours remaining if you're unfortunately on a terrible connection. Mm-hmm. During that 4 hours, you can't get a share link because it's not finished being uploaded. So you have to come back when it's done and then get the link and then send it to the person. And just that alone is like so annoying because like I want to just send them the link and then just forget about it, leave the tab open. I don't want to have to remember to come back. So like we just made it so that on Wormhole, you drop the files on there and then you just get the link and then you can send the link and then you're done. And then you leave the tab open and it'll finish uploading. The other thing we did is say they click the link before it's finished uploading. So you might think, oh, well, they're going to be stuck waiting on a loading screen or they're going to get a 404 or something. Not the case. What if you just said, hey, we've uploaded 3% of the file so far. Why don't we just let them view the 3% that we've uploaded? Let's just stream it to them. Like if it's a video file, let them click the video and let them see the first 3%. In fact, we even took it a step further. What if they open the video file and then they seek to the end of the video? Well, then why don't we make the uploader start uploading that part next so that they can get unblocked on their end and actually start viewing the video? We do all that.
Wow. And you built this just for fun?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, well, it was technically a company. I mean, we were trying to come up with business ideas and, you know, and something that could be like a company. And we started with that. And then that was where we realized like, hey, this thing is, you know, it actually started getting used by a lot of people. And including like, I think something like 30-40% of the traffic was coming from China. And so we were like, oh, people could be using this for some serious stuff. Like we should probably make sure the security is really, really good. And then that's when we started realizing like, oh, our dependencies are like a pile of code that it's like thousands of things. Like what's in there? And then we started thinking about Socket, and that's where we switched to working on Socket.
Isn't that what they say? They said the product you land on is the product you built while building the product you were building or something. You know, it's always that thing. You end up solving your own problem.
Yeah.
You solve your own problem and you stumble upon something like brilliant.
And you're just footing the bill for all this bandwidth. Like I can't believe I could just throw a 10 gig file on here and have somebody download it. Like I know that Backblaze is incredibly cheap. I did the math and it's like 20 cents per terabyte per day. So it's relatively cheap, but I can't imagine if it scales, it's probably expensive, isn't it?
It turns out it's not that expensive because we only store the files for you for one day. And then the files self-destruct. And we also use peer-to-peer wherever possible. So if that person opens the link at the same time, then, you know, it's going to use peer-to-peer streaming with WebRTC and WebTorrent, and the server's, you know, not going to be used. So, and then the thing we did is you can only download a file at most 100 times before it also gets self-destructed. So there's like a lot of kind of these limits in place. I think the bill is less than $1,000 a month right now.
Oh,
so
man.
Really not too much.
Do you ever get, between WebTorrent and Wormhole, do you ever get like movie studios or anyone knocking on your door trying to point the finger at you for piracy or anything?
It's never happened. And I think, I mean, I've been really, really careful from day one with WebTorrent to be very clear that this project is not intended for piracy. And it's been really squeaky clean from day one. I mean, we never encourage anyone to use it for piracy. We don't use any examples of piracy. And in fact, there's so many like other cool, there's so many cool things you can do with this tech that I almost feel like it's a lack of creativity to focus on piracy use case. Like, you know, just being able to build a peer-to-peer app is so cool. And like the idea of it, you know, is such a cool idea, like, you know, decentralizing kind of the web and cutting out the middleman. And I know that now a lot of that, I feel so weird talking about this because so much of this kind of discourse has been taken over by like the cryptocurrency crowd and a lot of the I know there are some true believers out there, But I do feel like a lot of the discussion around decentralization and this kind of stuff is actually kind of cynically motivated for these people's get rich quick schemes in some ways. So I don't, there are a bunch of people who were working on this stuff before all that happened that were, you know, working on this because of, you know, idealism.
Because decentralization was awesome.
Yeah, right.
It's true. Yeah. Think about it.
Certainly muddied the conversation.
Okay, crypto guys ruining everything.
Yeah. And I don't even want to generalize too much too there, because I also feel like, you know, even within cryptocurrency, there are some people, I do feel like the, some of the Ethereum core people, I mean, I'm not that up to speed on all that stuff, but I do feel like there's some kind of a core of like true believers there who are actually doing it for the true reasons too.
Yeah.
Totally.
They just have like this giant orbit of like cruft and scammers all around them, basically.
Grifters, scammers. Yeah.
Do you have any opinions on like, what was it? Radical. They were trying to be like the distributed GitHub. And I was like, oh, I got to check this out. Head over to GitHub to download it.
I don't know anything about this.
Oh, it was like radical? when Web3 was popping, everyone's like, radical. Like, they're not going to be able to take your code down. No one can take your code down. It's on the blockchain, right? So I'm curious what you think about decentralized code repositories when there's so much nefarious stuff happening on centralized ones.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly lose the ability. I mean, from a security perspective, you do lose the ability to like take things down. You do have to rely even more on like kind of scanning or your own protection, your own kind of out of band reputation system that can tell you whether something's good or not. That's the security angle of it. But I think these projects are cool. I hope people keep making them. I think that one thing I will say, and I'm not super familiar with Radical. I've definitely seen it before. I think it's a cool idea. I like their website design and stuff. But I think one problem with a lot of these decentralized projects is that they get really fixated on like how cool it would be if this thing was decentralized. And I understand that, because like I also think it's cool. I like the idea of like my computer connecting to all these people and like pulling pieces of the file and combining them together. And you know, it's like it's super like, you know, crypto punk, you know, cypherpunk. It's like super cool. Yeah. And like, you know, no one can stop me, man. It's the internet, you know, like we're all connected. And it's a cool vision. But I think they don't, oftentimes they won't think about like, what is it actually going to do for the user? Like, does that matter? Because I mean, there's a limited number of people that think that that's cool. That stuff is cool. It has to be cool for other reasons that like normal people care about. And the decentralization has to like make it, has to be almost invisible or in some way make it better. But what typically happens is the decentralization makes it slightly worse. It's like, oh, it's just like GitHub, except for it's like broken in these five ways. Okay. Or like, it's just like GitHub, except for it takes 20 minutes to sign up because you have to generate keys. And I'm not picking on Radical because I don't know how they work, but I'm just saying it's usually these things are usually like just like this other thing, except for worse. And then you're like, well, okay, why would anyone use this except for the true believers? And that's the problem. They don't think about that. And it's partly not their fault. Cause I mean, it's harder to build things in a decentralized way. It's like fighting with one hand behind your back, because you do have to like work twice as hard to like do everything and make it have as good of a user experience. And we learned that on Wormhole, you know. And then encrypting everything makes it harder to like, you know, show a file preview because you can't see the files. You know, you have to do everything in a different way. And this is why Signal Messenger is like slightly worse than the other messengers in terms of the user experience, because they're doing everything with their hand tied behind their back. And I don't know, it's a hard problem. And then, you know, it's not surprising that a lot of people don't make something that's as good as the centralized stuff. I don't know. That's my thoughts.
I feel exactly the same way. We've been a little bit critical on this podcast of it, and not that we don't think it is, but we're just like, just show me something that is better, you know? And like, I had a bunch of people send me this like decentralized store. It's like a decentralized Shopify essentially. And I was like, it sounds great, you know, like decentralized Amazon, decentralized, but like, why is nobody using it? And like, why is it not very good? So interesting.
You have to start from the like end user experience and then kind of work back, not from like the tech, and work forward.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
We have a show, the One Password folks are coming on to talk about pass keys. which is like trying to get normal people to care about security. You know, I'm sure you have all kinds of thoughts about that, but like these normal people don't want an authenticator app on their phone. It's not going to work. You know, they're not going to save it. They're not going to remember their login for that type of thing. So we need something else other than these two-factor authentication.
I need to listen to that episode because I'll be totally honest, even though I'm like usually really up on security stuff, especially web security, you know, like web authentication is like, I have a whole section in the class that I teach about web security, about authentication. I mean, I actually haven't looked too much into passkeys. I just haven't had time, been like really busy with socket stuff.
Yeah, so that's exactly why we're doing this podcast. Everybody's talking about passkeys, but I feel like most people don't know what they are. And spoiler, it's just public private keys, but they do it in
just
a way
with
where
nicer
your
UI.
iPhone is the public key, you know, or
yeah.
We'll talk to the folks from 1Passers. They are the experts at it.
Yeah, I mean, that'll probably be really, really good. Yeah, I've just been saying no whenever those prompts come up so far because I'm like, well, I like that I have 1Password set up. I have my password there. I have my 2FA code right there in 1Password. So like, I don't want to change. I don't even know what's going to happen when I say yes to that prompt. I've just been like, no, I don't know. Don't break it. It's already working. Just go away. You know, that's been my reaction. So I kind of really want to know now what their explanation of it is.
All right. Well, let's get into the part of the show where we do our supper club questions. These are the questions that we take and we kind of just ask general questions like, for instance, what text editor theme and font do you prefer?
Well, that's a good question. I think the theme I'm using is the GitHub Dark theme in VS Code. And the font I'm using is, I usually use Source Code Pro, but I think it was having some trouble in VS Code. So I think I might just be using the default now, which is, I think, Menlo or whatever is in there by default. Yeah.
When you NPM install something, are you using NPM, PNPM, or Yarn?
I'm still using NPM. I like PNPM a lot. Not a huge fan of Yarn. But I still stick with NPM. I don't know. We haven't made the switch over yet. It's Socket.
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately they'll kind of are the same at the end of the day. I mean, there's in terms of for the most part, I mean, we use PNPM for the workspaces and stuff. It's nice, but hey, everybody kind of gets their features.
Part of the reason too, is that our safe NPM feature only works with NPM right now. So I want to have that in place. Obviously, it would be really embarrassing if I got compromised.
Oh, yeah. Being,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Working on Socket.
Yeah. So. What was that guy who had the billboard that was like SafeLock or something, their social security number on his billboard, and he still got hacked? Yeah, that's embarrassing.
Oh, man.
What do you do to stay up to date on web tech? You seem to... know a lot of the newer APIs.
Yeah. So I actually do this mostly because I have a kind of a security hacker mindset and I always want to break things. And it turns out that knowing the newest APIs is a great way to like discover things that haven't been hammered on as much. And so have like potentially have a lot of flaws or ways they can be used that people haven't thought of all the ways that they could be used yet. So what's really good for that is just looking at the browser changelog posts that they do. Like I think Chrome has a good one where every time a new version comes out, they'll just put in all the new APIs that they're shipping, and I usually just follow that. There's also an amazing page called Project Fugu, which is also very Chrome specific. I'll post a link here. And Project Fugu is basically Google's effort to like make the web have all the capabilities of native apps. And if you go there, there's a great kind of like overview page where you can see on their Fugu tracker, like all these crazy web APIs that are like very powerful capabilities that they are hoping to ship in future Chrome versions and ones that they've already shipped. And so if you just follow this page, you can see kind of all kinds of, you know, crazy app ideas that you would not think could work on the web that might now be possible. So it's a really fun page to look through because you can get a lot of ideas for like, you know, things you never would have thought of before. But when you see, you just can see an API and then it's like, oh, just that one API can give you like 5 or 10 app ideas, you know?
Yeah.
New totally. Types of apps.
You know what? I went down the other day at lunch. The rabbit hole is there's a new serial port API. And you know what runs on serial port is receipt printers. And I was just thinking like, man, how cool would it be to print a receipt on like a thermal paper directly from the browser? And there's a couple, there's even a React API for rendering receipts and like converting it to whatever receipt printers need. It's like a special syntax, but I don't think there's anything that will directly, like I controlled a drone from the browser once, but I had to use a server in the middle. And now I'm thinking like, mm-hmm. you still can't do it. It was TCP, like you talked about. But some cool stuff there.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, no, I love this type of stuff because, you know, again, it's always, I love surprising people with like what, you know, with whatever you build, you know, that getting that reaction on their face of like, oh my gosh, like that, I didn't think that was possible. Like that's the thing that I love the most.
Yeah.
So like these APIs are a great way to do that because you can shock people with like, you know, wow, torrents in the browser. Like that didn't seem possible. You know, that reaction is the best. One thing that you can do to, or like one thing that I did with this like API knowledge is I built a site that tried to basically use all of the APIs at once. So like you could just try to build the most like annoying website. So I don't know if you guys have seen this, but I'll post the link there, and I don't recommend actually visiting it unless you're in an alternative browser because you might need quit your browser.
You Block Origin has blocked me from loading it. Did you know?
So yeah, we got listed by uBlock and Twitter. So you actually can't share the link on Twitter now. I promise you it's not malware. I promise you, it's just annoying JavaScript. There's nothing, you know, malicious about it. I promise you, it's totally safe. The source code is on my GitHub. If you want to look at the source for it, or you can just view the source. All it does is it just opens up like as many pop-ups as possible. It moves them around your screen. It downloads files into your downloads folder automatically. It's like what does the web let you do? And what if you just did all those APIs at once, just to make an obnoxious page? And that's kind of what it is. So it's the reason why people.
I opened it.
Uh oh. What's happening?
Oh, I force quit it. Good. Wow. That's, I don't recommend that. That is awful. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's one of the reasons why some people say that, you know, Chrome and these, you know, there's like kind of two visions for the web, right? Like, add more functionality in. And there's other people who just say it should be a document viewer, you know, and like, I don't really think anyone really argues for that anymore, but like, you know, this is kind of an example of what happens when you know, one of the downsides, I guess, of making the web so powerful is that, you know, you do visit a lot of untrusted sites and you do run untrusted code all the time from these random URLs you go to. But the browser does a pretty good job. I mean, at the end of the day, this annoying site can't really compromise you. So it's really just annoying.
It's just annoying. I love it.
That's great. Cool. So last thing we have here is a sick pick and a shameless plug.
So my sick pick is the Harry Potter audiobooks. I've been re-listening to the Harry Potter audiobooks by Jim Dale, and he's the best voice actor. He does all the voices himself, and I think he set the Guinness Book of World Records for the most voices acted by a single voice actor in an audiobook production. And it's just really good. And I just also will give a shout out to audiobooks in general as a person who spends all day on the computer screen looking at stuff and using my eyes. I really love being able to just rest my eyes. And
what's your preferred app for consuming audiobooks?
WebTorrent.
No, you should not use WebTorrent for piracy. Do not use WebTorrent for piracy. I tend to use Audible like everybody else. That's kind of the market leader. Yeah, they're probably totally a monopoly at this point. I mean, everybody uses Audible, I feel like. What, is there something else I should consider that's not Audible?
Actually, Spotify just rolled out.
They did.
170,000 audiobooks, which I don't know if that's a lot or not. It seems like a lot. So, and if you pay for Spotify, you have access to them all, apparently. I haven't checked it out yet, though.
Yeah, there's some weirdness, too, when you try to do it. You can't buy it through the app, even though you're not buying it. So you have to, like, do it on the website and listen on the app. Yeah, there's some wonkiness, at least in the States.
Interesting. Can I do one more pick?
Yeah, as many as you want. Absolutely. You can beat Darcy. Darcy had, like, 7.
Oh, wow. I'll do another pick for ChatGPT. I know everybody's, like, already aware of this and using it, but I noticed when I watch, like, my friends or other people in my family using their computer, there's all these tasks that they're not using ChatGPT for that they could be. Mm. And I would recommend people, if they want to understand, like, what can this technology do, just decide you're going to use it for everything. Like, don't write a single email ever again. Like, just for a whole week, just decide, like, I'm not going to do anything except through ChatGPT. And it'll really give you a bunch of ideas for, like, things it can be used for that you might not have thought of. And that's been pretty cool and pretty eye-opening for me to just do that and see. I now use it for a bunch of stuff.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
And then shameless plug?
I mean, use Socket. Go install Socket. It's a free install from the GitHub Marketplace. That's probably the easiest way to get started. Go to socket.dev, click install, and it's like literally 2 or 3 clicks to get it on all your repos. And if you're at a big company or you want to use it at work, get in touch with us. You can schedule a demo, and either I or somebody on our team will demo it for you. And we have a lot of cool customers now using us. You can see some of them on our website. Companies like Figma, companies like Vercel, they're all customers of Socket, and so it is really being used by some of the best teams now, and it's really exciting to see that. So if you want to use it at work and you like a tool that's built for developers and not annoying or noisy to use, like some of the other security tools you might be familiar with, then give it a shot, or tell your security team to come talk to us, and we'll explain to them why it's awesome and why they should consider using it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really fun. This is a cool conversation, guys. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.